Now we have a speaker who many will say doesn't need any introduction, but he's going to get one anyway, and it's not going to be a nice long bio. I bet that if we had that, it would be this long. So I'll just use a few words for Andrew, and one, of course, as you know, is Unitarian, one is musician, one is educator, administrator, traveler, and Scott supplied the word cook. And I personally have experienced his home-baked cookies. Wayne, remember when we were at his house for the lay chaplaincy committee and it was hard to leave without a handful of the cookies? He's also, in my mind, one of the deepest thinkers I have met. I want to call him a philosopher, but he wouldn't do that. I wanted to call him a seeker, you know, one who searches for knowledge, and he said, well, sort of, but he's this close to knowing everything. So, and while I'm about it, what do you think about our new sign? Woo-hoo! Yes! Most of the thanks on this goes to Andrew. Okay, Andrew. And by the way, you've detected the theme of mystery, I think, that goes through this service.
Well, thank you, Carol. Talking about the sign, can I share your brief story you talked about with the wind yesterday? It was a windy day, and Carol was just saying this morning that she had an experience in a parking lot where her cart was making its own way across the parking lot towards a bunch of cars because there was something in the cart that was catching the wind. And yesterday when Scott actually helped with the sign, so we were carrying the sign from Microprint over here yesterday, and we debated whether to do it because it was windy, and we thought, well, let's give it a try. And we got just outside the building here, and I thought it was just going to fold right in half, and I thought, oh my goodness, that'd be so bad. But anyway, it came here in one piece without any catastrophe, but it was catching the wind pretty well. On the back of our order of service, we have sources of Unitarian tradition. So we often talk about the principles, and I know we've had a series where we talked about the sources as well. The first one listed is direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life. I think that's more or less a summary of the talk today. So I'm going to carry on with what I've prepared. And it is about mystery and awe. I have the good fortune to be partnered with an academic who travels the world for work. It's fortunate because I get to go along. South Africa, Australia, Austria, Greece, lots of other places that we've been. And during those trips, I always have some time alone while Scott's working. I think about the time spent at the grave of Beethoven and how this place has been visited by thousands and how his music has touched countless people in the core of their being. And time spent at the Acropolis, where people have built temples and pilgrimaged since before Jesus was born. And the Grand Canyon, a place that took millions of years of imperceptible incremental erosion by nature's sculpting tools, the endless press of gravity, wind, and water, to produce something that alters the pace of my heart and breath when I see it at sunset. There is something about these moments. There is a feeling of awe, a response that is involuntary in each of these experiences. I think it is an experience common to us all, part of being a human being. But it's not always commonplace, because we often don't take a moment to pay attention, and we let our heads get in the way. So what is it, this experience of awe? Some describe it as spiritual. Like everything else, it happens in the presence of certain stimuli, which cause particular brain neurons to fire in particular sequences, which produce the surge of wonder that rises up. Those that resist the idea of spirituality can reduce the experience of awe to a matter of physiology. But in doing so, I think miss a tremendous opportunity. We can aim for a richer understanding. For me, I see awe as the experience that leads me to believe that which, on the surface, seems impossible. The evolution of life from inorganic matter into cellular organisms, into multicellular organisms that can breathe, bleed, and breed. And billions of people inhabiting a planet that is undetectable in the context of a universe with 1 billion trillion stars that spans distances too large to understand, and knowing there are as many molecules in 10 drops of water as there are stars in the universe. This is how I make sense out of these two words. First, mystery. I generally think of mystery as being engaged with my lack of understanding of something else. It's a cognitive gap. When I receive particular information to bridge the gap, the mystery disappears. But true mystery, let's call it mystery with a capital M, is that which we are incapable of ever understanding. It is the cognitive pursuit to understand the unknowable. And in the face of mystery, I experience awe when I am profoundly aware of the insignificance of myself. My life is so briefly insignificant compared with the lifespan of the Grand Canyon, and my body is less than a speck in the expanse of the universe. I resonate with an aspect of the world that takes me beyond myself. We all have the experience of awe, and when we attempt to harness it with our intellect, it becomes an experience of mystery. The experience of awe is itself a mystery. As I walked along the creek a few weeks ago, marveling at the beauty of the hoarfrost on the trees, I felt awestruck. Not so much by the frost itself, I understand how frost happens in cold fog, but rather on that day it was by marveling that I had the capacity to be moved by that beauty. The physical beauty of another human being can be exciting, while the physical beauty of a sunset can be calming. Why? I don't know, but it's pretty cool. Gordon McKeeman talks about how one addresses a mystery. So his question is, how does one address mystery? And there are 4 things that he says about that. One is cautiously. He says, and these are his words, "Let us go cautiously then to the end of our certainty, to the boundary of all that we know, to the rim of uncertainty, to the perimeter of the unknown which surrounds us." How does one address a mystery? Secondly, reverently. Let us go with a sense of awe, a feeling of approaching the powerful holy whose lightning slashes the sky, whose persistence splits concrete with green sprouts, whose miracles are present in every place and moment. How does one address a mystery? Thirdly, he says, hopefully. out of our need for wholeness in our own lives, the reconciliation of mind and heart, the conjunction of reason and passion, the intersection of the timeless with time. And fourthly, how does one address a mystery? Quietly. For no words will explain the inarticulate or summon the presence that is always present, even in our absence. Matthew Fox and Rupert Sheldrake have a little YouTube clip. I watched it just to see what they had to say. And they mentioned a few things. They said, mystic experience is the opening of the heart that results from the experience of awe. It's not just cognitive. They say children can access it more, but adults can experience it daily if we are present. It is moments of insight that change people's lives. And typically, they say, it's experiences with nature. And I've heard over the years a number of you talk about those experiences yourself. On Monday, August 5th, 1991, I wrote this in my journal. I watched the meteorites tonight. One has to be very patient, but the reward is worth it. They are fleeting streaks, but they are awesome. Hunks of rock falling quickly toward the earth, oxidizing in the atmosphere and burning white or orange. Their lives are short and pointless. They travel a billion miles unchanged, and then it is the air that kills them. They are shining briefly, and then they are gone, forgotten. In the mystery, in the mystical core of organized religion, David Steindl Rast says this, quote, "We've come to understand mysticism as the experience of communion with ultimate reality, with God, if you feel comfortable with this term," end of quote. It's understandable that personal experiences of awe or mysticism that bring us meaning would give rise to an attempt to capture and sustain that experience. This is done by establishing doctrines and rituals to keep the awe alive. Lighting candles, for example, is a ritual that puts us back in touch with the wonder of community and connection. But organized religion, according to Steindl Rast, can become centered on these structures and be suspicious of mystics, because those looking for direct experience may not follow the norms of the group. He goes on to say that, quote, "In every religion there is a tension between the mystical and the religious establishment. Every religion seems to begin with mysticism and ends up in politics," end of quote. He discusses three aspects to religion: doctrine, ethics, and ritual. In combination, these are meant to engender the founder's mystical experience in the adherents. But doctrine can turn to dogmatism, ethics into legalism, and ritual into ritualism, each becoming a barrier to accessing the mystical experience rather than a bridge to it. Steindl Rast says, quote, "Doctrine is simply the interpretation of mystical reality. It flows from it and leads back to it. But then the intellect begins to interpret that interpretation. Commentaries on commentaries are piled on top of the original doctrine. With every new interpretation of the previous one, we move farther away from the experiential source. Live doctrine fossilizes into dogmatism." That's the end of his quote. He goes on to say that in a similar vein, ethics are written into law, becoming inflexible and losing sight of the original goodness. And ritual, meant to celebrate the essence of the mystical experience, degenerates into repetition, where form is more important than content and distracts from the original goal. So we can conclude then that if religion is to be effective and grow and be meaningful, it must set up conditions that lead a person to be able to easily invoke that mystical experience and be free from dogmatism, legalism, and ritualism. Growing up in evangelical churches, I can attest that an attraction for many people to an evangelical church services is rooted in its ritual and its lack of ritualism. The mystical experience through ritual is at the forefront. The structure of the service leads to an ever-rising sense of closeness with the divine. Through music, lyrics often repeated over and over to bring the singer into a meditative place, the spoken words, the stained glass and depictions of Christ, the hugs and handshakes, whatever it is that helps people respond to that which is greater than themselves, is present and keenly felt. It brings congregants to the source. People are moved by the Spirit to speak in tongues and prophecies. It is an experience centered on rituals that evoke emotion rather than the ritualism of routine prayer books, where the focus is on form rather than content, the formalized, the fossilized, rather than something alive. The elements of Steindl-Rast's model correspond to the mind, the will, and the emotions, according to him. The spectrum of doctrine to dogmatism involves the mind. The span of ethics to legalism invokes the will. And ritual through ritualism stirs up the emotions. It would be interesting to use this model to develop a tool to measure our own religious practice on a spectrum of these three strands. How would we measure up? Do our Sunday services focus on one of these strands at the expense of the others? Which of these three particularly encourage us to enter a place of awe? What barriers are there that impede easy access to an experience of ultimate reality? We advertise that we have no dogma. And ethics, rather than legalism, is something we pay attention to. What about ritual? We have a set order of service. We stand for hymns, exactly two of them. We have responsive readings. We light candles. If the service leader goes out of order, someone usually brings us to their attention. So at what point does order lose its function of providing comfort and take on the role of distraction? That's a personal question. Some religions are driven to find converts, generally for noble reasons in the minds of the adherents, I suspect. When people ask me what Unitarianism is, I routinely fail to adequately excite them to the extent that they make the decision to attend the meeting for themselves. I'm much more likely to convince someone to visit a beautiful park or eat at a restaurant with delicious food. Perhaps people are more likely to believe that the direct experience of seeing or eating for themselves will benefit them more than religion, which is a mere proxy for the direct experience of awe. We experience our communion with the ultimate reality and are unable to adequately share it. Any expression of it reduces it because we bring only words, for example, that affect just the intellect of the other, not their whole being. I can try to convey my experience of the hoar-frosted trees or the meteors, but ultimately I can't do it justice. My experiences of awe while traveling abroad are ritualized when I download my photos from my phone, put them on a USB drive, take them to Moose Jaw, load them into my sister's computer where we spend an hour or two viewing the photos. But I'm always disappointed in how inadequately they help her understand the beauty that I've witnessed or the meaning I've derived from a place. There's no substitute for the real thing, even when the ritual is well designed. I think it's why some faith-based churches stress belief in a personal God. It's their way of saying that no one can provide the experience of God for you. It must be you who has that direct experience, who faces that wall of wonder at the unknowingness of everything. While no one can have the experience for you of God or ultimate reality or awe or whatever you choose to label that, effective religion might be able to trigger your own experiences so that you can relive them and nurture your spirit within a gathering of like-minded people. This is a vital function of community. But what if the experience that is so sacred is a lie? In one sense, this is a pointless question because every life is a partial truth. We all see in part through a glass darkly. But I think we could agree that there are degrees of unknowing, degrees of deception even. We may not know everything, but we might be pretty sure that we're more enlightened than the people worshiping at the church XYZ down there somewhere. But sometimes an experience is genuine, intense, full of wonder at the world, and yet it comes from a place of profound ignorance. A friend of mine in the past couple of years has had a radical shift in understanding the world. He sees through the lens of a vast network of conspiracy theory lies. Aliens and UFOs govern our planet and future. The elite politicians work together for world domination. The Earth will soon experience a cataclysm from an invading rogue planet. While these beliefs produce fear, they also bring him the experience of enlightenment and awe. He truly experiences a revelation of truth and mystery. While the facts may be wrong, the experience is genuine, and it's impossible to convince him otherwise. There is an answer for everything that ultimately distills to a reliance on what is unknowable using faith, perhaps no different from a belief in a six-day creation story. And a reason he is so strongly convinced is precisely the experience of owning his truth. In any pursuit, we find evidence, but ultimately we must leave room for the possibility of being wrong. This is how science operates. What if there is some fact out there that we discover that turns everything on its head, that throws into question all we know? How does or can the experience of awe change us? While the experience of awe is likely similar for human beings, between human beings or among human beings, the interpretation of that awe is different and leads to different outcomes. When I self-identified as a Christian, I would be in evangelical church services and have an overwhelming sense of awe at my place in the universe. I would feel a rush from the music. I would hear lyrics or a sermon and have a profound experience that I would interpret as the hand of God touching me, cleansing me, forgiving me, purifying me. I would then be empowered to go out and do various acts, speak about my faith to non-believers, pick up hitchhikers and quote passages from the Bible, pray and fast and fight temptation. I still have those experiences of awe, but now the outcomes are different. I am more likely to embrace gratitude, to have a renewed commitment to helping other people, to be more patient at work, or to refine my actions of leadership. In closing, I would encourage you to plan something today that will enable your being to experience awe. And as you do, marvel at the personal nature of the experience. And if possible, allow it to take you outside yourself, beyond what you control, and connect with whatever you call that ultimate mystery of existence. Thank you.